It's a great pleasure to have Jaron here again for his third or fourth visit to Perimeter. Jaron is easy to introduce for a short introduction, but complicated to describe. Jaron is a computer scientist, a musician, a composer, a performer, a pundit, a writer, a philosopher, you can say that. We're specifically concerned in this talk with his interest in computer science, and particularly virtual reality and enhanced reality, which he has been a pioneer of for most of his life. He's identified as the person who invented the terms and the concepts of virtual and enhanced reality. And I'll let him tell those stories. Part of his story, which he may not get to, is that when he was a teenager, he, through a story that's personal, happened to meet Bridget Feynman, who spent some time with him and got him interested in physics and what we do here. He's had contact with physicists and mathematicians throughout his career. For the last 9 years, he's been at Microsoft, and among the things he's been developing at Microsoft.
5 years.
There's a time problem, but we'll have to deal with that later. He has been part of a project to develop an enhanced reality device called HoloLens. And coming out of that project was a project that he organized over the summer to have some PhD students come and spend time at Microsoft Research developing different applications of HoloLens. And one of them was Andrei, and he developed the beginnings of a prototype of developing mathematics. And I'll let Jaron describe the idea, but the idea roughly is to invent new tools for us to do mathematical research using the tools of these new enhanced reality devices, and that's what he's here to tell us about. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. And I, you know, I was just feeling really comfortable sitting there, and I can still see all you. And I think I might.
Why
is that?
No.
I kind of like it because I feel like I'm in the same galactic plane. I feel like they're interacting more. Like, good. See, I mean, I can still actually see all of you. I think. Does this work for people?
Yeah.
Does it? And can you hear me? Can whoever's recording this hear me? No, I just lost the clip right. Okay.
I can hear you at the room. Can you turn the bell pack that you have on, please?
There's like a button on it. The other side. The other side.
That's just a switch at the docking center.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's great.
You would have to assistance from the director. I sort of feel like I'm the toddler who's getting like, I can just hold it. Sure. No, these things are intractable. You don't understand.
I I'm not totally. Then you can wave your arms around.
No, see, you don't. Okay. Are we all set? Everybody happy? All right. So, the personal story by which I met Feynman is actually very simply that my girlfriend, I fell in love with a girl whose dad was the head of the Caltech physics department when I was a young teenager, and ended up sort of adopted by the department in a very kind manner. The first thing, and I was, you know, I was a very, I was kind of a precocious kid. I'd already been through a lot of, I'd already been to graduate school by then and stuff. So I was one of these precocious kids like many other kids at Caltech. But the very first thing he taught me was a really interesting thing. He said, doing physics is in part about finding a way to manipulate yourself so your own mind matches up with the problem. And a lot of times, I find that to address a problem, I try to feel it with my body. I try all kinds of different things. I try to exercise every little angle within my mind to get at it. And the very, very, very first thing he showed me is something I still love, which is how to make a tetrahedron with my fingers. See? Isn't that great? right? And so, anyway, that was one starting point among many that set me down the path of being interested in virtual reality. So in brief, and this is too long a story to tell in one session, but when I was when I was very young, especially in my 20s, I had the tremendous privilege of being able to pioneer the field of virtual reality and made up the name for it, and then had a startup company eventually in Silicon Valley where we sold the first products, which the 1980s virtual reality system looked a lot like today's Oculus system, with the difference being that one in the 1980s that was even approaching the performance of today's Oculus system would have cost a significant number of millions of dollars per user, depending on what year we're talking about. But in general, we had like batteries of refrigerator-sized computers to support a single user to even get a slightly decent VR effect. So it was very, very expensive and very difficult in those days. But the basic, you know, like if you look at the goggles, the very first ones, and if you, the, like all this stuff actually was kind of similar. So I've lived through a few rises and falls of the fashionability of virtual reality. And that's a very healthy process to live through, where you can, so I have a kind of a healthy, I'm not skeptical of the current fashionability, I simply don't take it very seriously. The fashionability of an idea is not necessarily correlated with the quality, utility of an idea. Might be, might not be. Whether this particular wave of VR goes somewhere or not, we have yet to see. But at any rate, one thing that it does charm me completely is how many people, especially young people, are fascinated by VR. When I talk about virtual reality, you all know what I'm talking about, right? The thing with the goggles and all that. Anybody clueless here? No need for a basic intro, right? Okay, so one of the fundamental things I like about it is really kind of primal, which is just I find great joy in it, and I still do. Like if you look at people using different technologies, like with their phones, they tend to become very intense and obsessive, and then they become very obsessive in a more physical way with games. And there are various technologies that engage people in different ways. But when you see people in VR demos, they're just like, wow, there's just like this delight. And I love that sense of delight. To me, that's just wonderful. But I want to talk here more about the serious side of it and some potential directions where it could merge with the future of math and physics. Going way, way back to the early encounter with Feynman and some others that I haven't mentioned, I had this sense that what virtual reality could be really good for was building a bridge between the human mind as it is. Why don't you guys come down front? I won't spit on you, I promise.
Okay. You're not spitting either, are you?
Yeah, if you don't spit on me, I won't spit on you. Really. Like the mosh pit. No, don't worry, I'm not gonna dive into the audience here. I know theoretical physicists can get wild. I have a healthy appreciation for the dangers of being here. From my earliest enthusiasms in my teens, I had this feeling that what we could do with virtual reality eventually would be to bring our whole minds and bodies into encounter with different ideas and problems and learn to think and do things in new ways that might really transform how we perceive the world. I know that's the kind of sort of non-specific inflated talk that one hears in technology all the time, so I want to try to make it a little more specific with a few examples. I'll start with some extremely simple ones. That also demonstrates some of the perils, perhaps. One of the first demos I did, once we had a complete virtual reality system, meaning that there could be multiple people and your whole body was in there and you could turn into an avatar with other people seeing you, seeing your body and so forth, was juggling. So when you learn to juggle, if any of you have done it, you know there's kind of a step function where at first you're dropping the balls, then you suddenly get it, and then you can kind of do it, but there's like this moment where you have to get over the basic thing. Well, in virtual reality, you can make the balls move really slow, so you have plenty of time, and then you can gradually smooth them up. So where there was a step function, now you have a smooth path, right? Follow that? So that demo was very effective at showing that by being able to manipulate the world around you, change the laws of physics, basically, you could change the laws of cognition effectively. That in turn has created a whole field of virtual reality in rehab and all kinds of therapy. For instance, one variation of that that's become very widely used is phobia treatment and also PTSD treatment, where virtual worlds are used to very gradually and carefully control exposure to stimuli in order to try to help people learn to respond to the stimuli differently. And that actually all arose from this old juggling demo. So that's a happy story. Another early example, once we did that, we did another example, which was was the world's first real-time surgical training tool, where you could plan surgical procedures and perform them in simulation. That was done with Stanford Medical in the 80s. A couple of interesting things about that. One is that it's been very widely adopted. It's a very standard, normal thing these days. The other thing is that last year there was a meta study that showed that it's being overused and now causing more medical errors than it prevents, because people are training too much on the simulations, which are imperfect, and are relying too much on the quirks of the simulated bodies, which can never quite be like the range of quirks that you find in real bodies. So this provides us with initially a happy story, but also a cautionary tale that virtual reality can be used to confuse ourselves as well as to clarify things. And I think it's extremely healthy to see that. So another point here is that virtual reality has actually been around for a long time now. We're into decades of use. We've gone through whole cycles of use, overuse, misuse, then better use within a variety of industries. It's been at least 20 years since you've been able to take a ride in any kind of vehicle at all, whether it rolls or flies or floats, that wasn't initially designed in VR. So we're talking about a field that's established in some industrial niches and where we've learned a lot. However, in the last few years, there's this whole world of young people discovering it who don't want to hear about any of that. As far as that world is concerned, it's brand new. And those of us who've been in the field for a while are amused to constantly see these blogs or online tech journals that say, amazing new discovery in virtual reality, this is incredible. And we're like, oh yeah, that was 1982, right? But so they're rediscovering all these funny things. From the very earliest time, I was really interested in what virtual reality could mean to mathematics. And here, there's so much more to be discovered than is already known that the only way to talk about it is with a pretty high degree of speculation. One thing that always bothered me is that the way we express math to each other by writing down equations on boards or publishing them in papers is so distinct from the way we learn to think about them. Every mathematician or physicist I've ever known well enough to have a feeling for their cognitive style has really worked in two different domains. One is the domain in which they actually approach problems, and then the other is the one with which they communicate to the general field. Now, there are a lot of good things about that distinction. I think there's something really healthy about being forced to write compact, efficient, and precise descriptions of what one has done. So, and I don't want to diminish that's an essential process without which we probably couldn't have our present degree of advancement in math and physics. And yet at the same time, must these worlds be so disjoint? Must we have a world where people are doing, you know, whatever thing they do to understand a problem and then completely shift to a different gear to communicate about it? Does that make sense? Maybe there's a different way to combine these things. Now, there's been a lot of evidence over the years that cognition can be affected more profoundly by the modality with which a problem is presented in virtual reality than the example I gave you with the juggling balls. Another example, which some of these things have turned out to work without virtual reality. So in virtual reality, way, way back, somebody did an experiment where they had kids turn into letters with their bodies. So in virtual reality, you can turn into an avatar, right? You can turn into a lion or something. And so if your body, if you match your body to a particular position that looks like a letter, you could turn into a letter. They had kids turn into letters to spell, and suddenly they noticed that dyslexia seemed to disappear. And that observation, which started in virtual reality, has turned into a class of dyslexia therapies that don't need virtual reality anymore. But it served as a channel of discovery. Let me go a little bit deeper into avatar research, because it gives you a sense of how fascinating this line of research can be. So there's a famous avatar from the early days of virtual reality that I think is from about 86 or 87, I'd have to check, which is the lobster. How many people know about the lobster? So if you were virtual reality scientists, you would know all about the lobster, because it's a famous, it's an important avatar. So in those days, we were experimenting with avatars. And of course, the first thing one tries to do with an avatar is make it realistic. So you try to make, you know, hands with fingers that look reasonable and faces that look reasonable and that convey your expression without the creepiness that is often associated with doing that, which is a whole other topic. That's called the uncanny valley. But there was a bug. There was a bug, and I was in a. We had a contract with the Port of Seattle at that time. I don't know how this happened, but in those days, in the 80s, it was popular for major ports to model themselves in virtual reality to make planning models. And so we did it for Singapore, Boston, and Seattle, and a few other cities. And there was this bug where my hand was suddenly gigantic. I think it maybe got two or three orders of magnitude. I don't remember. But anyway, I had this giant hand. So here I was. I was supposed to be in like some plane or something above the Port of Seattle looking down. And there's a little ferry going around. And I had this hand that was just huge. And my arm was just gigantic, like this huge, huge crane. And it was just the bizarrest thing to look at this giant hand. And I thought, wow, bugs are cool. Because in those days, that kind of thing was still really novel. As it will be for a lot of people for the next few years. And then eventually you get used to it. You're like, ah, giant hand, whatever. But but anyway, here was what, that by itself is just cool. What was surprising is I could use this hand to reach down and pick up particular buildings and very detailed things. And that was surprising. Now, I need to explain why it's surprising. It's extraordinarily easy to do virtual reality badly. Now, you might say, it's rather easy to do physics badly, too. So what? And it's true. It's often easy to do things badly, but I want to give you a sense of how easy it is to do virtual reality badly. In many cases, if you change anything, like just the tilt of something or how long it takes to respond or just all kinds of little things, you can make people really sick and they'll throw up. Now, this is not generally a problem you have in theoretical physics, although I've seen it. I've seen it. I'm looking around here, it looks pretty clean to me, so I think you genuinely have a sort of a higher degree of expected hygiene, I think, in a theory department. So at any rate, I'll tell you one funny story about the early days and the throwing up problem. So this is called simulator sickness sometimes, or VR sickness. In the mid-80s one time, we had an arrangement with the director, with Steven Spielberg, to put VR systems in a big truck and roll them down to Hollywood so people could see it. And it was called Reality on Wheels. And in those days, the Universal studio was still run by this classic Hollywood studio runner guy. His name was Lou Wasserman. And this is all stuff you don't need to know about. But anyway, we're putting like lines of people through these demos for the first time. And it was just like what you see today with Oculus, except it was much, much earlier, a different generation of people and super, super expensive equipment and all that. So very, very rarefied and unusual. And this guy, Lou Wasserman, says, "Come over here, kid." And I was like this, "Oh, yes, Mr. Wasserman." I was like this really jumpy little, you know, enthusiastic kid at that time. And he said, "Are people going to get sick in these things? I heard that somebody vomited yesterday." And I said, "We have been studying that problem. We really understand it. We have it down to 1 per 1,000 now. Soon it'll be 1 per 10,000, then 1 per 100,000. We're gonna make this so rare that it'll effectively be solved." And he looks at this and said, "Hey, why are you bringing me a kid who doesn't know the first thing about entertainment? And I'm like, what? He said, kid, I want to see headlines about how all my janitors are quitting because of the vomit. That is how you sell tickets. And I'm like, okay, we can do that. Anyway, the struggle to overcome simulator sickness was a long one and still not completely. But I mean, basically, the modern equipment, it's very unusual for somebody to have a problem. At any rate, so seeing this giant hand and being able to control it to not feel any sense of nausea, to not have any cognitive confusion was a surprise, because disorienting people in virtuality is extremely easy. That is not hard to do. So we started to study this, like how can it be that you could have that much of a distortion of one's body and not lose any functionality? How is that possible? And this led to an amazing tract of research that continues to this day of trying to map out which avatars are immediately usable by people and which are not. And so there's a continuing project at Stanford mostly these days, and a little bit in Barcelona, where people are testing weird avatars and trying to map out an atlas of what's usable. One of the hypotheses about this is that what we're really mapping is the evolutionary adaptation and pre-adaptation of the brain to different bodies. So in other words, if we're looking through the deep time by experimenting with avatars, we're seeing what the brain still remembers how to do after hundreds of millions of years, and also what it's pre-adapted to do in the next hundreds of millions of years, what creatures we could evolve into. Because every adaptation in biology is somewhat fuzzy, retaining a little bit of its past and opening up potential futures, right? So it becomes a lens into deep biological time. We have discovered a lot about what you can do with avatars. Now, this is of great interest to me for many reasons. One is that if you look at the real estate in the brain devoted to controlling the body and to managing senses from the body, it's vast. It's much larger than that devoted to vision, sound, olfaction, etc. It would be a mistake to be overly linear and say, well, therefore, you could be smarter if you use more of that part of your brain. It's not so simple, of course. And yet, there is this huge real estate of the brain. Could we maybe tap into it? There's been evidence for a long time that we might be able to. One of my favorite examples, since I'm also a musician, is that a jazz pianist can solve problems in harmony in real time while playing faster than if presented with exactly the same problem to be solved on paper. So somehow the body is directly connecting with logical problem solving in real time and performing operations faster than the mind can do otherwise. So we have a concrete example that's been studied and repeated a number of times now that shows that the body is a modality to abstract thinking is something that's real. Now, how far that could go, whether it could be significant in other ways, of course, we don't know. However, one does imagine some future where some future version of Feynman is like dancing around and turning into different equations and all that. I mean, like, I don't know what this looks like in the future. I don't know how crazy this gets. I'll tell you, so let me bring this up to, by the way, I don't even see a clock here. When am I supposed to stop? At 3:30 is when I stop?
Yeah.
All right, and you'll probably want to ask questions, right? And I'll show a video, so I can't take too long on this.
We don't allow questions.
What? What?
Don't worry, there'll be questions.
There'll be questions? In the last years, I have a post at Microsoft Research, as Lee mentioned, and we've been interested in this type of, this is not the only thing I do, but it's one of the things I'm still interested in after all these years. And we've been really interested in 3D interactions. We did a 3D camera called Kinect, you might have seen, and then had this crazy idea of trying to bring out a mixed reality headset for consumers, and this is a thing called HoloLens. So, at this point, the terminology is becoming a little torturous, but the type of VR that was most prominent in the 80s and still today, we can now call classical or occlusive VR or something like that. That's where you're totally closing off the world and you're seeing nothing but the virtual world. Then this other thing, which we can call, so originally the other thing was called mixed reality, and that's where you still see the normal virtual world, but there's extra stuff added. And mixed reality was also my term, but in the 90s, the company Boeing became very interested in it. One of their engineers liked augmented reality, and they were paying our bills at that time, so it was augmented. So augmented reality is also a prominent term. I still kind of like mixed reality better, but at any rate, mixed reality has existed for a long time. In fact, even in the 1960s, Ivan Sutherland, the founder of Computer Graphics, had built a preliminary mixed reality near-eye display, which he called the ultimate display. But as far as something you could just really walk around with and go to a lot of places and multiple people could see things, I mean, that was something that had never been done. So HoloLens will be the first device in that category, absolutely not the last. There are a lot of people working on similar things now. We still have much to learn about them. But there's one thing that had never been done. Nobody had ever done a social version of it where people could walk around and all see the same virtual stuff. And that was like this undone research piece, totally fresh research. So my thought was, it was time to do it. How do we do it? Do we do it as a big fancy lab thing like HoloLens with all this secrecy and all this money? No. Let's do it with students. So I got a bunch of doctoral candidates from different universities and just got them in a room and got them to work really hard and do it over the summer. We made it work. Andre, of course, participated in that project and very, very beautifully, I might add. Thank you, by the way. That was just, you did great. It was amazing. I had been really nervous about bringing him in because I didn't want to corrupt him. I was thinking, oh God, like taking somebody who's a theoretical physicist and then dumping them into computer science, is that like some kind of fall from grace or something? I don't know. But anyway, it worked out really well. And the nature of the project, I don't know how to put this exactly. I've had a concern that technology has a problem with too much money. And that might sound like an odd thing to say, because everybody's always fighting to get more money for whatever it is. But it's just been so insane in the last few years. For instance, since virtual reality became profitable again, I think there's something like 1,000 funded VR startups. And this is not just people saying, oh, I have a VR startup. These are people who've convinced other people to give them substantial money. And then among the big companies, every one of the big tech companies has put in at least on the order of tens of billions of dollars into it, which is real money. I mean, that's serious. That's like enough to feed whole developing countries or something. I mean, it's like just extraordinary. And I feel as though there's something that's been lost, which is that ultimately the way you figure, sometimes you really do need to spend money. You can't build an LHC in your backyard. It's just not gonna happen. But also, a lot of times what really matters isn't so much spending a lot of money, but just clear thinking, hard work, dedication, and that sometimes if there's enough money, it actually gets in the way of that, because it's like all these people who just want to be rich, and there's just all, everything becomes kind of crazy. So I thought for the first multi-user mixed reality experiment, maybe we'd go back to the old ways, and since the students are used to starving, they wouldn't even know what resources they're not getting, and do it the hard way. So at one point I had Andre completing a lens or a mirror or something, or just cutting, right? You had to cut some glass.
Well, yeah, it was something about
that. Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, so instead, like basically start from first principles. And it's another one of the people who got me into what I do, I had the very good fortune when I was a young boy that one of our near neighbors was Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered Pluto, the planet. But he also ran optical research at White Sands Missile Range near where I grew up in southern New Mexico. And he taught me to grind lenses and mirrors when I was a little kid. And he had these amazing backyard telescopes where you could just see a globular cluster like it was just sitting there. And that's what taught me my initial optics for learning how to make the head mount displays and all. And just the thing of actually making your own lens, it's a really big deal. Like everybody should do that if you care about any data that comes from lenses, because you have to start from first principles. You can't just order reality from a catalog, you know. All you can order from a catalog is whatever somebody else has already thought about, and you have to learn to bypass the catalog. It's just essential to framing things. Anyway, we did this project. I'll show the video, I guess. And it's okay if I'm barefooted. I don't know. just think of me as an American barbarian, if you like. And then I have to.
Let's see if we can make the lights better.
Let's see if my Windows Surface will actually wake up quickly. It might have just like updated or is this? Okay, here we go. So this is like a little video from the end of the project, and hopefully the sound will be on and everything. Okay, so that's probably enough. There's like credits. All right, so I want to say a little bit more about some specifics about what we might do. Then I can do questions. Yeah, you can bring the lights up. All right. Audiovisual remains one of the great unsolved problems, along with a unified theory. All right, so what might we do with virtual reality and math? Well, there's a couple of areas that are kind of obvious and a couple that are less obvious. So one of them is visualizing interesting geometry. Now, I want to say it's not just visualizing, because we've been able to draw pictures of interesting geometry for a long time, and you can rotate the geometry on the screen. But to actually be able to pick something up to manipulate it is really different. It's really qualitatively different, just as Feynman showed me with this tetrahedron. Like, when you experience a tetrahedron like this, it's actually different. You're really feeling the topology of a tetrahedron. This is different than looking at a picture. Back when I was in my 20s, my friends and I at the time, we couldn't imagine some distant future when we'd have our own children. That just seemed like such an incredibly weird and remote idea that it was impossible. But we made a pact that if we ever did have our own children, we'd put them as babies into little virtual reality goggles and then switch them out for bigger ones in their sleep and raise them in a four-dimensional world. So they develop four-dimensional intuition. And of course, when my daughter was born a little over 9 years ago, and I tried to imagine explaining this promise to my wife, and I thought, maybe this is a promise I can break. Maybe, and none of my other friends have done this either, of course. It'd be quite a project. But I told my daughter about it, and she was like incensed that I hadn't done it. I could have grown up in four dimensions and I didn't get to. And then she said, well, it's not too late. You know, you have to make me every four-dimensional thing in virtual reality that you can. So by you make it, of course, it means get a graduate student to make it. She we all know what that means. And so I got Andre to make that hypercube that she was playing with. And the thing about playing with a hypercube in mixed reality is that you really can develop intuitions for it. Not instantly, but after a while playing with it, I think even somebody who's very, very familiar with thinking about hypercubes would learn more from doing this. I think it'd be the rare person who couldn't learn more from doing this. I think even Coxeter would have. Earlier today, Lee brought up a couple of examples of geometric proofs he's read that he'd like to be able to get a more visceral feeling for. Interesting ones would be, I don't know how to visualize, but I'm really interested in. Surely there's more to be done with that. And I'm pretty sure there's some mathematical structures that are currently obscure to people that might be made more intuitive and might find their way into use in theories more often. We don't know. We just don't know. So that's one area. That's an area that requires a lot of work because you have to think about how to design each one. For instance, Andre's first approach to the hypercube involved two-tracked balls to control the degrees of freedom, and then it shifted to one-tracked three-dimensional cube and one-tracked ball. And that, I think, worked better. Would you agree? Yeah. It was better, right? And so there's a constant and challenging design process that needs to happen. It's not automatic. It's an ongoing process, and there might be people who turn out to be geniuses at coming up with ways to present geometries this way. All right, so then another example that I have been intrigued with since I was a kid that we've never really fully implemented goes like this. Right now, when you put some math up on a board, you can see where people erase terms and replace them, right? And you'll see that. You replace a term, but at any given moment, the board is static, and it has this Platonic, timeless statement stuck on it. But in fact, what happens with mathematicians and physicists in a room is that boards are dynamic, and they're going through changes. And what I imagine is a lens metaphor, where each function is a lens. And in those cases where it's possible, you can look at real data sets through it and see what it does to the data sets. And then you can compound them, you can form them, but you can branch them. You can say, well, maybe we replace this term, and I'll have this lens look at that, but it might also be that term. And then you can have the structure in the room of different alternatives, and multiple people can be walking around, playing with it, looking at data through it, sometimes looking at data through one direction and through the other direction in those cases where there's a reversible function that can be calculated numerically. I've had a vision of something like that, of this structure. Is that clear enough? Do you follow it? So what would the value of that be? Well, I think we have to build it to find out. It's possible we'd build it and we'd say, cute, but too much trouble. We might build it and we say, fantastic for education, but not for professionals. But what if we built it and it actually mattered to professionals and it actually changed or accelerated or opened up ideas? You know, and that possibility fascinates me completely. I think it might. And I really want to see that tried. I really want to know what's waiting on the other side of that experiment. And I don't think it's predictable. Well, there's so much more to say. I feel maybe this is a good stopping point for the talk, though, because it leaves a little bit of time for questions, and then other things will come out of the questions. So why don't I say that's the talk, and then I'll take questions. So do I just choose people, or do you have a tradition for how to do this here?
We can men.
Hmm?
We can men, I think.
There might be no questions. Yes?
So could something like planar algebra be incorporated in a virtual reality format to kind of do mathematics, but more intuitively using some shapes and manipulating them?
Yeah, you know, the question is using doing linear algebra.
No, planar algebra. This is
planar algebra. I'm sorry.
Vaughn Jones
came
up with this algebra, you know, which seems to have this, you know, kind of a intuitive pictorial representation.
Right, right. I've seen that. I'm very open to it. I'd love to see it tried. It's going to be a really, really worthy experiment. I think people have done some things with that on the screen, but. And there might be higher dimensional analogs that are interesting too. To answer the question that I misheard you saying in linear algebra, I'm really interested, you know, Microsoft, which is putting out HoloLens, also owns this thing called Minecraft, which is like a kind of a virtual Lego world that kids like for making blocky things. And I keep on imagining these blocks being matrices and being able to do matrix operations with the blocks and maybe teach kids quantum information with it or something. I don't know. It's very easy to say something like that. Actually working out the design details to do it is a completely different level of difficulty. That actually can be very hard.
Question. You mentioned how this is an old technology when used and widespread. And yet we're in a very modern building here and you know, there's no such thing as any virtual reality tool. So is it What's happening here? Is it because of us? Is it because of why?
Well, what else are you missing here?
What?
What else are you missing here? I don't know.
No, but you were saying it's something very common, but in some sense, for most of us, we have never been using it. So
there's been for the last.
So it's not
for the last year or two. There have been cheap little VR development kits that you can get that a lot of people are hacking on. So there's thousands upon thousands of people. The New York Times is giving away little cardboard VR viewers where you stick your phone in to look at panoramic news stories. So every subscriber has gotten those last week. So there is a pretty widespread thing. Why is it?
Every subscriber in the United States.
Ah, okay. I don't know what to say to that, but there is VR in Canada, I assure you. I assure you. In fact, for what it's worth, the very first sort of immersive video VR was something we did with a Canadian in the 80s, Graham Smith, who since moved to the Netherlands but was running the McLuhan Center in Toronto for a long time. And so that actually had its origin in Canada, if anybody asks. So this thing the New York Times is doing was originally Canadian. But as to why it isn't the Perimeter Institute, I don't know.
So why is it not part of a university system? Or well, part of, like, I mean, is it my
usual problem lately is I go somewhere to lecture and they say, oh, you have to see our VR stuff. And it's kind of like a rehash of stuff from 20 years ago, not very good. And I'm like, oh, it's great. You know, and I'm like, so that's my usual problem. So you have a chance to start from scratch and do it fantastically, originally, and like, so I would view it as an opportunity, not a problem. That's what I would say. as for why it isn't here, I mean, the thing about VR is it's non-trivial just to get the headsets and that kind of stuff to work well. For instance, the reason we made our own headsets is that HoloLens wasn't really suitable for this particular research, as you know, for various reasons. So we had to make our own headset. So that's hard, but I would say designing the particular experiences so that they're valuable is even harder. It's real work. It's not automatic. So given the amount of work involved, one shouldn't get involved with it unless one is willing to do that work to do it well. And a lot of people get involved without being willing to do that work to do it well. So there's a lot of the unfortunate and inevitable side effect of the new popularity for VR is that there's a flood of mediocre VR stuff out there, which there wasn't before. It's an inevitable side effect, but there's no mediocre VR here, since there's no VR at all. So you have a chance, a chance to do something splendid. Yeah.
So how much of the benefits of VR that you're thinking about mm-hmm. are tied specifically to either the stereoscopic or immersive nature because I know I do simulations, we do a lot of visualization, 3D visualization is absolutely an invaluable tool. You grab something, spin around, but we do this all looking at a laptop screen.
Sure.
And so how much better could that be?
Well, we don't know. I would view that as a research topic. But the reason I started with the story about Feynman and the tetrahedron is that I think the key to VR is I like to think of us as pioneers exploring the cortex and opening up new parts of the cortex and to be used in new ways. And this giant piece of this huge undiscovered continent, which is how to use the motor cortex for things other than running around, for problem solving. Now, we use the motor cortex for problem solving all the time. If you look at a fine athlete, they're doing problem solving with their body in real time in extraordinarily impressive ways. So it's not anything really new, but it's never been applied to problem areas that aren't intrinsically about the body, with the possible exception of music improvisation and a few other things. So I think that the homuncular angle, if you like, or the haptic angle is probably where the most benefit might be discovered, but I do view it as basic research and we don't really know. I think the visual side of it is less important than the interactive side of it, which is the body part of it.
I want to ask your view about the possibility of inventing new branch of mathematics through this 3D visualization. For example, invent some algebra that the presentation just cannot be done in two dimensions and can only be done in 3D. And those mathematics is like human haven't invented yet.
I'm really interested in that. It seems to me that it's almost inevitable that there's math out there that we don't know about because it's hidden from us by our modalities for communicating math. And that, to some degree, mathematics has relied on improving communications technology. I mean, without being able, but in a very broad sense, like if you went to some culture that had no concept of written language and didn't write things down, it would be very hard to express certain kinds of mathematical ideas. You need to be able to make some persistent mark to be able to express them or have any practical approach to them, right? So having this sort of more dynamic form of marking, might it open something up? I mean, of course this is speculative and we don't know. But it seems to me that there ought to be things hiding out there. There ought to be things hiding in plain sight that might be valuable. But, of course, we don't know.
Just add one thing, like, for example, for a non-commuting structure, like you write an equation on a line, you add on the left and the right,
right,
it's different. And then in 3D, now you have an extra dimension.
Yeah, yeah.
That can do some new algebra.
I think there might be new algebra. I mean, I think it's possible. I think there might be things out there. Let me do this and that.
Do you think there's also the possibility of certain types of thinking becoming more lazy if we have access to these things? For example, if you had opened a watch and you don't start tinkering immediately because you might just ruin it forever. In virtual reality, you could just tinker forever and try to to fix it instead of really thinking deeply about it before moving any piece. So with the ability to tinker, do you also think there is a risk of becoming a bit lazy in certain points?
Right. Well, this is one of the reasons why I opened, nearly opened, with the story about how surgical simulation ended up being overused. So we've already seen with some of the mature applications of virtual reality precisely this problem, where you can overuse or misuse or lazily use a technology like this. And I think it's absolutely essential for everyone involved with it to be aware of that at every stage. By the way, I think you can overuse all sorts of tools that we use all the time. I mean, I think what one often sees people in technical fields who become specialized in a particular thing, just apply that thing over and over and over again, even to the point of absurdity. I mean, I don't want to get specific with this crowd, but maybe you can think of some examples. So it is very important to have an awareness and a skepticism about any tools you use. I think that's absolutely essential to using them well. This is a point of confusion sometimes, where I find people say, well, how can you both be sort of promoting this and then talk about all the problems with it? And to me, having a realistic appraisal of tools that might be available is essential to using them well. I mean, I don't view that as a negative thing. I just view that as part of attaining competence in using anything, is being able to try to understand its limits, its dangers, its trapdoors, the way it might fool you. That's part of the package. Lee?
Well, I was really responding to Gwen's query with some examples. So there, for example, higher category theory is an extension. Ordinary category theory involves diagrams on a piece of paper, which is closed. Higher category theory involves higher dimensional analogs of those closure diagrams. And there is research in Marantes and other people have written papers on higher category theory. And it's just tough to get into because you have to understand the closure, the definitions, and the algebra simultaneously in several dimensions. Another example is twister theory, where we love to reduce things to the lowest dimensional example and then learn them in a dwarf, but the lowest dimensional interesting example of twister theory is three complex dimensions. Homomorphic function of three complex dimensions.
Right.
And there is research and then people who are very good at it, but it's tough to get into. Because having a tool like the one you described might help us get into whether we can invent mathematics that we couldn't have conceived of before, I don't know. They can certainly provide tools to help us work with higher dimensional structures of mathematics more constructively and more speedily.
Yeah, I think twisters are certainly a great example. The way to define an aspect of a research agenda in VR in the future for math might be to have like some sort of a structure where people consider and choose specific examples and then set a path of coming up with a design for each example in the course of a year and then see how far they got. Like actually structured around particular examples, of which the ones you just gave were great. But I want to emphasize that this isn't... There's this funny rhetoric in the technical world that everything's supposed to be automatic, free, cheap, easy, instant bliss. You know, this is not like that. This is like hard work. So for each one of these examples, there would be a lot of false paths and a lot of hard work to get to a good design. But then I think it could very well turn out to be worth it. I think it could be extraordinarily worth it.
So one of the...
I'll take you.
So you talked about your daughter and living in a four-dimensional world.
Yeah.
And you said she was able to develop some intuition for how that works. You know, I know that when I wander around in a place, I develop a map in my head of where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the sort of thing that, is this going to permit us to have an intuitive way for looking at higher dimensional spaces of one sort or another?
Well, this is why it's so interesting to imagine actually having a baby grow up in a four-dimensional space in the first place. Although exactly how that would work and what it would mean would require some further refinement, certainly. But right now, there is a three-dimensional structure. Actually, it's complicated. There are a few different structures to how you map the world around you that we've started to understand. And we're right now living in an era where a lot more data is coming in about exactly this sort of question than even very recently. I mean, there's really extraordinary data now coming in about how the world is mapped in brains. For instance, while babies haven't put in VR, well, babies have been put in VR, but not persistently, but lab rodents are put in VR with little sensor arrays in their brains so that they can be put in VR, and we can see how their brains distribute energy to represent places. And so it's kind of mostly a 2.5D map, I might say, which would make sense because we evolve on the surface of a planet that's kind of a 2.5D environment. And there's different maps for the environment. There's some that are closer in and some that are further out. And it's a very interesting world that's very particular and not very sort of generalized in the way we design computer graphics, for instance. But what we don't know is how plastic it is. So I think an amazing experiment, let's suppose that the mathematics and physics community develops a fantastic 4D visualization tool. Well, one of the first things I want to do is I want to take the heaviest users of that tool and put them in fMRI machines repeatedly over some years, so be aware, and see if we can start to detect neuroplasticity in which their brains are adapting to four dimensions. And so what we might, and I think that's entirely possible. The brain is not infinitely plastic in all ways, but it's remarkably plastic in some ways, and we don't know, we just don't know. So I think you're next.
You almost answered my question, actually. I was wondering about the same thing about being able to get used and gain intuition for stimulus that is not natural for you otherwise.
Right.
I was wondering if you had examples where it had been successful or where it had been tried but didn't work. Like,
there's some wonderful examples that I just in the nature, because of the time limitation, I kind of stopped myself. I mentioned the lobster avatar. I didn't actually explain. The lobster was the first avatar in which the body parts of the avatar didn't match up to the human body plan. So lobsters have those extra little arms, you know? And so the question is, how do you control the arms? So what we did is we took the parameters that we could measure from the human body, which in those days were with motion capture suits, the very first ones, actually. And you might take a little bit of a wrist, a little bit of a neck or whatever to control the middle joint of one of the little arms here. So you basically just grabbed some data from the physical parameters and redistributed them to a different set of virtual parameters. And people could learn to operate a lobster avatar. Yeah. Big surprise. Children almost instantly, adults after a brief period of adjustment, all of a sudden you have people controlling extra limbs. So since that time, so this is called homuncular flexibility. It should have been called homuncular plasticity, but it was late at night when I wrote the thing. So anyway, and there are labs that just study this now. So a lot of people have done tails. And as I was saying, this has to do with the evolutionary heritage. So since we lost our tails only recently, if you give somebody a tail, they can learn to use it spectacularly well with great accuracy and very quickly. So tails are easy, but we've done all kinds of other things. So you can start to explore the modifications. And so that's a way we can give the brain stimulus that it has never experienced in life, and yet it still intrinsically is ready for. It has experienced it in the phylogenetic tree, however, right? So we have never experienced life in four dimensions, I don't think. Right, well, except for you guys, yeah. But so this is why it's research. I mean, we really don't know what what stimulus, and see, this whole stimulus is inadequate, what interactivity people would respond to. And I think we have, so I'm watching my 9-year-old, and I'm probably a biased observer, so don't take this as real science, but she was picking up Andre's hypercube, and after a while, she's able to line up edges, and she can find the same thing, and she's like getting it, she's starting to get it. And I think that's pretty cool for a little kid. So, so she's starting to get a little bit of a simple four-dimensional object, and could it go further? I don't know. I'm gonna try. I wanna see. I'm gonna try to push her, get her to visualize more and more, and see where I can go with it. I'll be cruel. I'll make her do it. It's like, oh yeah, you want to eat that Halloween candy? Okay, I want this.
Speaking of the hypercube, we've only been speaking about vision, but what about touch? What
right.
State of the art? Can I touch a hypercube?
Yeah. So ideally, we. So this is in. I'm past time. Can I keep talking?
We're not on question session.
What?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So this gets complicated, and I haven't gone into a lot. I've been sort of just smoothing over a lot of the details of how to actually do VR and the challenges involved. So in the trade, we call this the haptic modality. The way you feel things is actually pretty complicated. It involves a number of different systems in your body. There's the tactile sensations, which are sensor cells in the skin, and they are extraordinary. There's a great variety of them, and the way they're distributed and the way they work together is complex. Then there's proprioception, which is your internal sense of forces and shape within the body, and all those things are combined together. When you pick up something, even a light thing, you're actually feeling its center of gravity, its weight, any momentum it has. You're feeling with your whole body. Essentially, your whole body becomes like an accelerometer tree that your brain can analyze. So, how do you do that in a generalized way? So this is complicated. I've had a project going for 20 years now called the Octopus Butler Robot, which is an attempt to make a fully generalized approach to it, but it won't happen this century, I don't think. Well, maybe, I don't know, but yeah, so I'll explain that. This is just to give you a sense of what a general system would look like. There's a mimic octopus, which is this specific octopus that can change its shape, very flexible, and also has display skin, so it can mimic all kinds of things. It can turn into a Coke can or whatever. And this is real. It's naturally occurring virtual reality. And so what we're doing is making a robotic device inspired by its musculature that can turn into all kinds of different shapes. And so that's so that you could feel different shapes. So that's the octopus part. The butler part is, if you imagine, so synesthesia, crosstalk between senses, is absolutely central to virtual reality functioning. And this is, I haven't gotten into the cog sci side of virtual reality at all in this talk. That's a whole other interesting talk. But let's say you're slamming your hand down on something. So if you see the shadow converging and you get a satisfying slap, but there's no physical impediment, your hand will still stop in most cases because your brain believes there's something there, right? Unless I tell you that's what I'm doing, in which case it'll go through because I've ruined the illusion for you. And so in this sense, it's a little bit like stage magic in that the way something, like the information available to the person, tremendously affects how they perceive illusions within the system. So it's an interesting game-like. It's a game theory question of how much your brain knows at a given time, so how much it can learn, what guesses it's making. It's very, very interesting. But anyway, let's suppose, what if I wanted something to actually be there physically to stop your hand? Well, you can imagine this very rapid butler with a tray. And the butler just comes up and puts the tray there just before your hand is. All right. So then as far as your brain is concerned, it's always there because you're in classical virtual reality and you don't see the robot. So that's, I told you the octopus part. I told you the butler part. Now, in order to actually make this work so you could feel something, you'd have to have a skin on the butler that could scroll in the opposite direction of however your hand is moving on an object that's larger than the octopus. Do you follow that? So there also has to be a scrolling skin portion, and the skin has to be able to change its texture. Prototypes of this thing are being built all the time. So the problem is I've been working with a collaborator at Stanford named Ken Salisbury for decades on the Octopus Butler robot. And I think he's getting to the point of saying, oh my God, it's decades of this thing. I don't know, but that would be one approach. That a lot of people have other ideas, like tiny little microbots that form themselves into structures before your hand hits them. Or, like, there are all kinds of ways of thinking about, but you'd have to have some kind of physical thing that would actually resist, you know, offer resistance or offer force against your hand.
What about the suits that were popular in the 90s?
Yeah, well, so we actually made the first motion capture suits for virtuality. They are still used today for special effects input. And the problem with suits is you have to put on a suit. I mean, I really have to say, just like keeping motion suits like clean and then dealing with them, it's really not great. It's fun. That's why we made Kinect, more or less, so that if you can do remote sensing and get body pose from sensors without having to put on something, it's just a lot easier for people. Of course, if you're doing remote sensing, you can't convey any sensations at all. So another complex topic that I'm not going to get into is tactile illusions, where you can use various buzzers and other things to create illusions of different kinds of sensations in the body that are, in some cases, but it's somewhat limited. And as in the case of the hand going through the virtual desk, if you tell somebody what you're doing, the illusion goes away in many cases. So it's a subtle process. So that's just the beginning of a picture of it. There are people who are trying to bring back gloves and suits now. And it'll be funny if those turn out to be popular. Because initially I was like, after doing gloves and suits for many years, I was like, oh my God, thank God we have enough computing power to do remote sensing now, because I'm sick of having to deal with these clothing items. But maybe they'll come back into popularity. It's funny how things go. You know, there's some kind of a clock that runs on a few decades in which different styles of computer science or physics, for that matter, might go in and out of fashion. So this might, maybe it's coming back. Anything else?
Why don't we take, if there's somebody who hasn't asked a question yet.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing, actually.
Yeah.
I have a question. I'm not a physicist, I'm not asking a math question, but I'm curious about your research and how you do it in your lab in terms of what percentage of it is blue sky, foundational, and the other percentages are percentage that's applied. And if there is, how do you triage sort of the tech transfer? Does that come into the equation at all?
Personally?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't sought to develop self-awareness at that level.
And how about, like, you're working within a corporate structure. How does that work? You just have blue sky.
I get away with stuff. I just don't know. I'm amazed they don't kick me out. I have to tell you.
I'm thrilled for that. I'm just curious.
I don't know if you know, I have another part of my career where I write books on the future of economics, and I'm profoundly critical of the tech companies. And I'll talk to the CEO of Microsoft and say, wow, you really trashed the whole way we do everything. That was really interesting. I think, like any researcher, do you ever get this feeling like, I can't believe society's letting me get away with this? I'm here working with this weird structure that might go nowhere, and yet somehow they're paying for my life. I don't know. I mean, I'm amazed it works.
Yeah, so you have
what?
Somehow the zeitgeist of that particular work that you're doing is something that the corporate structure is, maybe it's just like a company that says, you know what, this is our R&D and we don't actually care. And I'm asking for that because I think it's important the way we message about why physics is important.
You know, it's so interesting. So the guy who runs my lab is named Peter Lee, and you should ask him. Like, why do you support some weirdo like Lanier in your lab? I don't know.
Or
what he'd
why
say.
Not? Why don't you do more?
It's an interesting question. I would find it very stressful to be a lab runner. I find it stressful even just like Anytime I have to make decisions about resources, like who to hire or any of that kind of stuff, it drives me insane. I find it so hard to make judgments that affect other people. It would make me just, I could never stand the stress of it, but somehow the people who do let a few people like me get away with things. I don't know.
No, that's good.
That's, I mean, I wish you know, I don't really have a great answer for that. I feel lucky anyway. I think they do feel like they get value from me in various things from various at various times, you know. But just recently, in the U.S. we have an enormous problem right now with this sort of short. At lunch I was talking about this thing that our Republican presidential candidates had a debate this week, and half of them decided that their new target, since it's considered bad form to attack, Hispanics or gays or whatever the usual ones, they decided their new target would be philosophers. I'm not making this up. You can look it up online if you want to torture yourself with American politics. You know, they're saying, oh, our problem in America is all these philosophers. These philosophers are ruining our economy. And, one of them said, God, the society shouldn't allow anybody to train as a philosopher. Welders make more money than those guys. And all this weird, like this incredible hostility towards philosophers. And I actually got a call yesterday from a fact checker in a magazine that was writing something that included me. And they said, we had you identified as a philosopher, should we change that? Another thing, that there was just an editorial in the Wall Street Journal last week suggesting that basic research is a waste of time because we can make technology without it, and technology is the only thing that actually makes wealth. I don't know if any of you saw that. And I thought, oh my God. So I don't understand. Well, and sadly, I think I do understand how this happens, and it's not my favorite aspect of humanity, and it just requires constant explanation and constant pushback and constant patience. And I always, when I try to communicate about this stuff, I try to get across just how much joy there is in it. I really do, because I think being able to do, like this summer project, I got so high from this thing. I just thought wasn't this just great? Wasn't it incredibly fun? And I think if people could just understand the joy of thinking about new things, exploring new things, and just going somewhere where people haven't gone before just to see what's there, if they could just get that feeling and understand why it's so lovely and be able to share it a little bit, that sometimes helps. But I'm amazed that this is even a question. I really am.
Yeah. So with that summer project, where does it go from here? Are you going to be following up all of the things that were developed?
Well, we're talking about doing some follow-up stuff here at Perimeter. Who knows? I'm sure. So maybe should we call that it? I think that it looks like people have to go, so.
Well, Jared is there, and Jared is here all day.
I am.
Unfortunately, just one day, but he's here today. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thanks so much for listening.